Yeah. Here's the formula. The wavelength equals the speed of light in meters per second over the frequency in hertz.
Yep.
Bang. You get your wavelength.
Oh, I can do that in my head.
Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, yeah. Welcome to GCP Bytes, episode number 8 for Friday, the 17th of January, 2025. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech. And I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, Happy New Year. We are back for 2025. We take a look at what Starlink is up to. Google has some new hardware, plus NVIDIA has some cool hardware as well. We check it out in the AI wars. But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing awesome, mate. Doing awesome. Glad to be back.
Happy New Year. And, of course, our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you, Ian?
I'm good, thank you. How are you guys going?
We're going good, mate. We are going good. Getting lots of rain here. How's things been? How's your new year?
Wet. Very, very wet. As I say to Dave this morning, it's humid and sticky here up in Queensland. It's currently 23.9 degrees, feels like 29 degrees and 97% humidity, just for fun.
Yeah, not that different here. There was a big rain front that came through and basically went from up your way in Coffs Harbour almost all the way to Melbourne. The entire coast was covered.
Yeah, it's like the one from yesterday?
The big band? Yeah, like last night.
Yeah. Yeah, they came through hard but short.
Yeah, that was that brutal little storm we got at about 1 o'clock this morning.
That's right, yeah.
It was quite the lightning storm.
Yes, but the size of it is what was quite amazing. It is a new year, we have all the usual stuff to cover. There's a lot of stories that came through during the new year, and I think we've picked the teeth out of them.
Yeah.
And what about you guys? What did you get up to over Christmas and New Year's?
Well, so we got the call up last Thursday to go and pick up the new car.
Woo-hoo.
So I did that, and we were already out camping. We're out at out the back at Imbal. So we drive down to Nambour, pick up the new car. It's great. It's fantastic. It drives like a dream. Decided I'm going to have to wire in a trailer plug and the Anderson plug and everything. So I jumped the Super Cheap, grabbed the gear for that, because the caravan's got a 12-pin plug on it and the car only comes with a 7-pin. So you've got to change the plug over and put the wiring through. So I went and grabbed all that, and it was rain. Basically, every time I'd finish work, it was raining, absolutely pouring down. So I was like, well, I'll just have to do it on Sunday morning. Like, I'll get out of bed at Sparrowfart on Sunday morning, and I'll get out there and wire the car up. And it was so humid on Sunday morning, I was a lather of sweat by the time I've changed the plug over. We went and hooked the caravan up, only to realize that some dummy decided he'd pick up a 12-pin plug as opposed to a 12-pin socket in what he needed. And none of the shops in Imbal had a 12-pin socket. So he had to unhitch the caravan, drive all the way to Gympie, pick up a 12-pin socket, and then drive all the way back and wire it in. So we didn't get out of there until it was nearly midday. And I'd been going since, I think I got out there at about 5:45 in the morning.
Oh, dear. A six-hour epic just to change a plug.
Yeah. So I had to wire in some 8mm cable for the Anderson plug and the fridge wiring in the caravan goes through that 12-pin. So they call for 6mm. So I put 8mm in because I had to wire both the Anderson plug and that fridge out of the same wire.
Yeah, nice. Right. Bit of a saga there.
It was a nightmare. But it was a good camping trip. Apparently, I didn't see much of it. I was too busy working.
Oh, that's good. I mean, I also picked up a new car over the Christmas break, but mine was a bit more straightforward than yours. No, no messing around. But
the BYD?
It is, yeah. It's the Sea Lion 6, so it's a like it's got about 100 Ks with the EV range on it, and petrol kicks in for the rest of it. So we sort of took it out to go and stay at a in-laws have a place that's about a 4-hour drive away. So we sort of gave it a run. So we got it on both battery and on the engine as well. So yeah, it drives nice, but I don't really need to think about it beyond that. So,
and how's the BYD experience though?
Oh, it's nice. Once, so the only thing that I found, you know how like, well, BYD has it, and certainly like plenty of current cars now have like the street sign, like speed limit recognition. Right.
Oh yeah.
I thought that would be a good thing. Turns out, no, real pain. Like, because every time you'd go past a speed sign, say like a school sign, right? But it's school holiday, so school signs don't apply. All right. But the car doesn't know that. It can't have doesn't know how to work that out. So it goes 40 and it starts alerting you that you're speeding. You're like, but you're not speeding. Or, you know, you've driven through like a car park. And it'd be like 10 Ks, but then you get out on the main road, but you haven't seen a street sign yet. So it would start complaining about that. So when I got into it, like I was sort of driving it for a few days, I'm like, I don't know, I'm not kind of relaxed driving the new car yet. Like it's this, I sort of feel like I'm working harder. Why is that the case? And then I worked out how to turn it off. And thankfully when you turn it off, it stays off. It's not like every time you start the car and immediately different. It's funny how just this little thing with this little tone that would go off every now and again and alert you takes those cycles in the back of your brain when you're more actively looking at it. And because you also get the, it would show the, you know, what it thinks the speed to be. It would show that on both the, you know, the instrument cluster, but also on the heads-up display. So you're sort of seeing it in these two other places, and it conflicts with, you know, what you see on the road.
Right.
And
yeah,
so
it makes
what
you question things, eh?
Yeah, and I think what I found subconsciously is that, you know, because we are so wired to always be looking at the speed sign. Right. You don't even think about it, but you just do it. Having it on the screens in front of me meant that I was checking that. And sometimes, yeah, it's like working out which is actually the source of truth. And obviously, the one on the road is the source of truth. That's the one that the police will find you on. That's
it was
the
one of the
one.
Things that really annoyed me. My wife's old Corolla had that.
Right. And
yeah, exactly the same thing. It would just see the speed sign and go, oh, you're in a 40 school zone. You're in a 40 zone. And it just start dinging at you. Like
it's like, no, ding. It's 10 o'clock at night.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. No kid at school at 6 o'clock in the morning. I promise.
It's little thing. But thankfully turning off has it solved that bugbear for me. So
I love it because the patrol has none of that.
No, that's
literally
right.
None of it.
blunt weapon with a purpose. That's why. Well, I had a similar experience. I had 2 weeks over in New Zealand across the ditch, and we were on a little vacation over there for Christmas, and we hired a RAV4, and it's a 2024 model RAV4. So it had all the bells and whistles. And
super popular, the RAV4, very popular,
but it had the adaptive cruise control, the lane assist, it had this thing with the speedo as well, but I think it was actually getting it from GPS data, not from camera detection. And I thought, great, I'll go and turn them all on. Now I hadn't driven it because you know I'm a patrol owner, we don't have any of that stuff, right?
What is this power steering?
Yeah. No, we've got power steering. We just don't have any of that other
stuff. So ABS brakes.
much the same. Turn on the lane assist. This is great. You know, this is going to help me stay in the lane. And much the same as you, Dave. I found I was spending cognitive cycles, normally ones that you would spend keeping the car in the lane. I was using cognitive cycles to because you can feel it pull the steering wheel. So I was using cognitive cycles just
to
correcting
manage
that and
yeah.
checking on that or manage that all the time. And then, of course, it would bing at you because, you know, we all do it. You go around a corner, you just cut the corner a little bit or you just shave off the apex a little bit so you can go a little bit faster around the corner.
Well, you've got to have that optimum driving line.
You've got to have the optimum driving line, exactly. And it would constantly bing at me for doing it. I'm like, hang on, I know what I'm doing here. Just let me drive the damn car.
So I'm not an 18-year-old.
So I ended up turning the lane assist off as cool as it was. And I showed my wife, I didn't take my hands off the wheel. You're not supposed to do that, right? But I showed my wife.
You're just going slightly like this, shadowing
and it's
the
like,
wheel, yeah.
See, it's driving the car. It's moving. And she's going, stop it, stop it.
So
cruel, the Corolla used
cruel,
to do
but
that.
Like, nah, I don't want to do it.
Our old Corolla used to do that. You could take your hands off the steering wheel. You put on cruise control. Yeah. You put lane assist on and all that nonsense on. Yeah. And it would literally do it, like the whole thing for you, right to the point where you come up to a set of traffic lights. And as long as there's a car stopped at the traffic light, it'll pull up to a stop.
It'll pull up.
And then when the car goes, it'll go again.
Yep.
So.
That's right. I found the braking was a little too aggressive though. That was my issue with it. I tend to try and make that as smooth as possible when I pull up, but it would brake quite suddenly and be quite a bit jerky.
I think it definitely depends on the implementation from the manufacturer as well, because my Skoda, which is now, it's a 2019, yeah, it's like 5 years old, right? The implementation on the adaptive cruise control and the lane assist are a lot more refined, dignified, even versus the BYD implementation. The BYD one, I think, like what you're talking about with the RAV4, Banky, the adaptive cruise coming to a full stop is, you know, it kind of wants to brake later than I would. Like, I feel like I'm approaching the car in front too much. The Skoda doesn't do that. It keeps a much more sort of smooth distance. And the way it does lane assist is much more gentle. You don't feel it pulling too much. Whereas the BYD feels like it's making kind of corrections all the time. Like, it's a little jerky in how it holds. So I don't use it so much on the BYD, but I use it on the Skoda all the time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Yeah, the RAV4 was much like that, and I just found that, you know, I'm not fighting it, but I'm always trying to figure out what it's doing, whereas I might as well just turn off and drive the car normally, because I just do that without any, you know, spent cognitive cycles.
I love that, because the new patrols have got lane departure assist and all that sort of nonsense, and I love that it's turned off by default. You've got to turn it on. But it remember, like, if you turn it on and then switch the car off and walk away and come and start the car back up, it'll turn it back on for you.
Well, I mean, that's good, because a lot of cars don't do that. They'll let you change things, but only while it's on this time.
Yeah, so what I found was when it was turned on, and I deliberately, like, I was testing it out on one of the back roads, and I deliberately, like, veered across the center line, and it yanks the car back. And you can't do that with nearly 3 ton of car. Yeah, it sort of tends to roll over a little bit.
Yeah, it's a lot of energy. Yeah.
So,
and with a trailer on, a big
caravan on, yeah. That's a bad recipe. So, I just turned it off and I left it off because I don't need it anyway. I'm quite capable of driving a car.
That was about more all my tech adventures. Other than that, I've just been blissfully unaware of any tech or any news or any updates until we got back into the show. But speaking of caravan and camping and getting out there, we've got both Telstra and Optus talking to SpaceX.
Yeah, I mean, this is great. We've definitely talked about it a bunch on the podcast, that it was something that was going to be coming. And, you know, we knew that Starlink has been working on their direct-to-cell stuff for quite some time. And they recently switched it on for the Florida hurricanes and, you know, the stuff that happened over there. But coming to Australia very soon, it seems like, maybe a little slower for Optus.
Optus was the one that first signed. They signed back in 2023, by the looks of that.
Yeah, so it looks like Optus is finding that it's going to take a little bit more testing before it switches across. Now, a bunch of this might actually be not so much on Optus's side, but on SpaceX's side, because it is contingent on them launching their updated Starlink satellites that have the radios for it. It's not like the original ones that went up, like, you know, a few years back. Now, of course, they're launching all the time, like a few times a week, right? They're putting new satellites up, but we do need to get the right coverage up before, you know, Optus would want to commit, and Telstra, of course, to commit to a level of service coverage. Of course, the big benefit for us, though, is that when they put in satellites to cover the United States, that covers a lot of Australia, because we're in the opposite inclination.
Yes.
right? So
So it has to orbit around.
Yeah. So that works really well for us.
Convenient.
Yeah.
So have the satellites got the 5G radio in them and it's powerful enough to get down from there? Is that how it works, or do you need a special handset for it?
You do not need a special handset. So these are direct to cell. You don't need any like Iridium kind of booster thing. This is very much able to use your existing device, which is, you know, is amazing, right?
Super cool, yeah.
Yeah, I think you need, from an iPhone perspective, I think you need iPhone 14 or better, and you need a reasonably new Android.
Right.
Yeah.
So any recent Pixels will probably do it.
Yeah. But I
did see that Telstra is only targeting the iPhones at the moment. Probably a smaller base to test on.
Yeah, I think it's just more. It's an easier thing where they can say, like, "Well, we'll test on this handset. It's like the most common handsets that are in our fleet. We will work on those."
And it eliminates the variables as well, right? You only got one variable at that point. Yeah.
So I understand what they would do that. So initially, this is definitely going to be for like kind of emergency calls and text. With the expansion to voice services and then low speed data coming a bit later on. But I mean, the ability that you could have standard handset and you could be, you know, at the back of Burke and you can, you know, be able to call for help if you need it. Perfect.
At the back of the black stump even.
I guess it opens up the possibility of hotspotting as well. Like, that'd be cool to be able to use your phone as a hotspot without having to take this whole Starlink, you know, mumbo jumbo with you.
Well, it would be nowhere near as fast. It would be nowhere near as fast.
Oh, no, but it'd be something, right?
Yeah. But like the full Starlink service, you know, if you're sitting out in the middle of nowhere, as you know, Ian, you can get a really good download speed because you're not competing with anyone.
250 megasecond, no problem at all out of my Gen 3 gear. No problem at all in the middle of nowhere. So, and even we were at Imbolc, and like a lot of the town of Imbolc uses Starlink for their normal household internet because the internet out there is so garbage. Even sitting out in that area where I'm sort of partially obstructed by trees and all that, I'm still getting sort of 150, 175 megasecond out of it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It interrupts every now and then where it sort of loses a satellite for a second because it dips behind a tree and it's waiting for the next one to come up. But that's what happens.
Yeah, compared to, you know, if you didn't have it.
Yeah, if I didn't have it, I'd be on 5G. And the 5G bandwidth at Imbolc is very small.
You need a giant antenna off the back of the caravan, right? Yeah. Big tower that goes up 30 meters.
The backhaul doesn't have much capacity. But, yeah.
Well, my 5G Nighthawk modem came into its own in New Zealand because I was able to take it with me and I bought a skinny mobile SIM. And I was for, you know, $40, I got the SIM and they had this double data thing. So I ended up with 500 gig of data.
Nice.
And just had to activate that on one of our phones, plug that back into the 5G Nighthawk, and bang, I was hotspotted that, and the whole family had Wi-Fi while we were away. Wherever we went, I just took that with me. We had it in the car. We had it. It was fantastic. It was definitely the way to go.
Yep.
Yeah, bro, very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Now, what's wrong with Gmail order summaries? Who put this in here?
I put this in here. All right. Start rant.
rant.
You know what really grinds my gears?
Tell us, Dave.
A strongly worded letter is incoming.
More of this AI bloody swap shovelware nonsense into everything. You know, I know we're going to talk about AI later and like how great it is, but stop implementing it where it's wrong. Just stop it. Like the... I've already ranted about the Gmail, the Google, the AI.
I have not
improved since my last rant. But now you're getting the same thing in Gmail, like at the top. Say if you have a look into like,
jump into your Gmail and have a look at
like if you've got a receipt for something that you've purchased, right? And, you know, you'll get that come through. You get this little summary at the top And a bunch of the time that they're wrong. It'll be like, you've ordered one item, but it's like, no, you've ordered four things or the quantity's wrong. It's like, it's pulling the data through wrong. Right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So like,
I've got an eBay receipt here, like a PayPal receipt, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that what I'm looking at?
Yeah. Yeah. Anything that has like items and quantities and stuff. And I haven't found it on anything that's come through for me, or like, it was my wife that raised it to me initially, because I hadn't even noticed it being there. Mm. And yeah, a bunch of them are wrong. It'll be like, you've got incorrect quantities, incorrect pricing.
Mm.
It's like, so why is this here? This is now the information's in the invoice. The information that now this top thing, which is taking my focus because it's right at the top of the page,
yeah,
has got the wrong info.
Yeah, okay. I can't say I've noticed that. I've just looked at a few invoices now, and it seems to be correct for me. Mm-hmm. So that's AI generated, we're saying,
yeah,
is it? Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's an expansion of like the thing that pulls in if you've got like a if you buy tickets to an event and it starts pulling that kind of stuff through. But yeah. So,
well, you've got the little, is this correct? Thumbs up, thumbs down.
And it is incorrect. Yeah, yes, it is not correct.
Help them train their model, Dave. That's the way this works.
Why, right? Well, then I should be reimbursed for that.
You should be. That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Well, you know how you get paid? Have you ever done this thing on your Android accounts where it will ping you to like scan your invoices, like your receipts and things? You can turn on the rewards. Have you never turned that on?
No.
Oh, man, I did that for ages. So you can get Google Play credit by sharing your location data with Google, and they come back with like, I think it's opinion rewards. Man, let me dig it out.
Yeah, no.
So
I share enough information with Google.
Yeah, but they pay you direct for it. It's like, okay, do this questionnaire. Like, hey, you went to this place. Did you buy something? Yeah. Or you watched this on YouTube recently. Was it like what you were looking for? And then you get like, I don't know, 40 cents, 50 cents every time you do one.
Yeah, right.
And okay, it'll also pick up like if you go, like it definitely used to do this at Bunnings. You go to Bunnings, it knows you're at Bunnings because it's got your location. And then it'll be like, hey, do you want to scan a receipt? And if you scan your receipt in, they give you like 60 cents.
Right. So that's an app you install.
Yeah. Google Opinion Rewards. It's been around for years. Okay.
I did not know about this.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a nice way to pay for anything on Play Store. You can also use it for paying for your like YouTube Premium subscription.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's good because it's giving you real money, not just some stupid
point
system or something.
Monopoly money.
Yeah. No.
But I wonder then, like, that's then building a profile on what you buy and what you eat and where you go and
Of course it is, yeah. But at least you're directly getting reimbursed for it. So it's I feel like that's more honest, right? It's not just I'm sharing this data for some back end thing.
Yeah,
it's like, okay, well, I've been paid for it, well, fine.
Yeah. I could have opted out, you know. I've opted into this.
Yeah.
That's the difference, yeah. All right, so we hate AI overviews and go and get Google Opinion Awards. Okay, that's the short and curly.
Cheers to AI overviews and cheers to rewards.
Love it.
All right then, enough of the banter for now. Let's get on with the community news. Ian, you stuck these in community news. Tell us all about it.
I did. So Google GDG Cloud Sydney is the first cab off the rank this year with their meetup on the 4th of Feb at the Mental Group office. At the Mental Group office in Sydney. There's a link there to the GDG site so you can register. Google is running from March through April, and we'll mention this a bunch of times right through until the end of April when it finishes, the Build with AI workshop. It'll be at a local GDG community in your part of the world. It's a Google-sponsored thing, so it is actually pretty cool. And then GDG Melbourne has a February coding night on the 19th of the 1st. And again, that's at the Mandel Group office in Melbourne. That's all the community ones I can find for the moment.
Nice. Things are slowly gearing up for the year, I suppose.
Yeah.
Get out to those. And what are we coding at this coding one in Melbourne?
Oh, so they do all sorts of cool stuff in Melbourne. They've got such a big community down there. Yeah. You go in there and it's a coding night. So it could be working on a group project or it could be working on your own code. And it's a lot of similar people coming together and helping each other out with their project.
Yeah, right. It does say here, make sure you have your IDE, e.g. Android Studio, of choice ready to download and download and installed, and something you want to learn or work on. Nice.
Yep.
Go and check those out. Links in the show notes. All right. Well, having said that, let's get on with the news items. And first news items this week is some news from a couple of Googlers. Matthew Zwielinski, well-known Googler around Sydney and friend of Mantle Group, has moved on. He was the CTO and director of Google Cloud Australia and New Zealand. He started there back in March 2020. But in January, he announced his resignation from there and he's moved on now. He's now the Senior Director of Solutions Engineer at Wiz. So that company that makes a little smart light globes and all smart devices you get around the place.
Yeah, he was always a lovely bloke to talk to, and every time we met up with him, he was such a great bloke. So I wish him all the best at Wiz, and we'll miss him from Google.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I met him once. Yeah, as you say, very nice bloke. I'm sure he'll do well at Wiz. And while on the subject of people, Cloud Wars, and we've talked about Cloud Wars before. It's a blog. They discuss, what's going on with AWS, Azure, and Google. Cloud Wars has nominated Thomas Kurian, CEO of the Year. Primarily off the back of Google Cloud's yearly success, which included a Q3 growth of 35%.
Oh yeah, the big one that I saw here, which obviously goes into the AI wars later, is all about the improvement in Google's AI. Although as we've just seen, maybe not perfect.
Maybe not perfect. There is an interview with Thomas Kurian on the Cloud Wars website. I recommend you go and have a look at that. They delve into the Q3 growth, the AI cost reduction, the fundamental shift that we've seen, particularly with Google Cloud, with cloud cost reductions and their real strong driver for business growth throughout the year. So that's really what's put Google and Thomas in this position. Links in the show notes. But talking about last year and this year, we had some big stories last year. I thought we'd kick off really with this. And an article that's come into SDX Central, they talk about some of the biggest stories that they had during the year. And no surprises, four of their five top biggest stories of the year were VMware related.
There was a lot of VMware stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a lot
Not
of VMware.
Not much of it good.
We covered a lot of VMware stuff. And, we're at the coalface as well for a lot of that period. Now, I personally was. I was very much up to my knees in a lot of the migrations and things that were going on. But just quickly, they dive into Microsoft Office license release, discounts for VMware migrations. So Azure there helping enterprises move in and offering VMware discounts. Broadcom pushes VMware deeper into Google Cloud, and we're going to see more of that this year. There's no doubt. Google is going hard with VMware. There's still a lot of enterprises that are on-prem, and it must be costing them an arm and a leg. And even though there's been some relief from Broadcom in terms of new licensing arrangements, it can't make sense. Once the bean counters see it, it just can't make sense to continue with it on-prem.
No, that's right. And I think Google's still the only hyperscaler that offers that full end-to-end VMware experience, where they deal with the licensing and the support and all of that in one spot.
No, you're right. That's the standout difference with Google's offering.
Mm.
It's the same experience that you would have on-prem, but Google just deal with all of it, all the licensing, all the problems, all the back-end stuff, you know, yeah. They manage it all.
No dealing with like, oh, okay, actually, nah, this isn't a Google issue. This is a VMware one, so you need to call VMware support instead. Nah, none of that.
And then VMware goes, nah, this isn't a VMware issue. This is the Google issue. Go back to Google.
Yeah. Ugh, so bad.
We've all been there.
Like talking
We've
to Telstra. All been
there. You've dealt with P1s while you're doing that. It's like, don't care. I just need somebody to fix it.
Yep. Don't have that problem.
Another Microsoft-related story. Microsoft stands by VMware post-Broadcom. That was a big story. Broadcom pulls VMware cloud distributions from AWS. So This particular story, Broadcom is taking over distribution of its VMware cloud product running on AWS. VMware is no longer directly sold by AWS. There's really only one hyperscaler in the game at the moment, the way I look at this.
Mm.
And then sort of from left field, one of the other top five stories was, why AWS, Azure, and GCP cloud native firewalls suck?
Well, yeah, and I don't really get that one, because GCP's cloud firewall now is actually Palo Alto backed for a lot.
Well, it's probably when this article may have come out earlier in the year, right? And during the year, we've seen some significant improvements with VCP firewall, right?
Yeah.
And firewall policies and things like that have been introduced.
Yeah, no, the article was released on December the 1st last year. So it's well after, because I've been using the Palo Alto implementation of GCP's cloud firewall for months and months and months now.
Yeah.
It's been fantastic. I love it.
It is good. It is good. So there you go. 2024 dominated by VMware, clearly. All right, let's move on then. A little bit of AI news. And Dave, I know you were big on this. You were super excited about this before it even arrived. But Google's AI video generator comes to Google Cloud customers.
Yeah, so I actually went back and reread this article. So this is actually a little bit different than what the one I've been excited about. So there's two things I've been very keen on, and which has now released, is Google Vids, which has come out for workspace customers, right? So I can use it right now. In fact, my business partner has gone and made a video using that tool. That is much more of the... kind of a workplace tool, you're actually making like kind of corporate videos, that sort of stuff. You can use the AI features in there to, do voiceovers and backing tracks and change like slides and transitions and a few things.
Right. So if you want to make a little training video or something like that, that's what it's for.
It's excellent for that, right?
Yeah.
So very excited that that's in there now, because we were using it like a separate tool that you had to pay for to do that kind of work. So love Google Vids. Cheers to Google Vids.
Cheers.
But no, this is another system called Veo, which is actual video generation, create 6 seconds video clips from images and text prompts. Right. So I think more of an open Sora kind of solution.
But it does say that it's a competitive tool to OpenAI Sora, Adobe Models Runway, Luma, Meta, and others.
Yeah, correct. So this is Google's one of actually doing general video generation.
Yeah, cool.
And available through Vertex AI customers, I think, currently.
Yep. And it only does videos in 720p, in 16:9 or 9:16 portrait.
Mm-hmm. Right. But, you know, great that they've got a solution for there. But, yeah, a little different to the one that I needed.
The bit that stood out to me in this article was that it understands VFX reasonably well from prompt and has somewhat a grasp on physics, including fluid dynamics, which is...
Oh, I was about to say exactly
the same thing. Yeah. That one's a... Because the fluid dynamics bit is the hard bit for AI to sort of generate stuff around.
You tend to see a bunch of stuff. I mean, not so much from a fluid perspective, but things tend to look weightless.
Yeah.
Right? I feel like you should see resistance and, you know...
And you'll get some artifacting and whatever in there.
Yeah.
It also, you can mask regions of a video and have it work only on those masked regions as well, which is clever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess if you've got an existing video you've got something in the background or you have nothing in the background and you need to put something in there, you can sort of select that and off you go. And and I see that as a really good use for this sort of tool. I know Adobe on the image side of things has like kind of a magic fill solution. So if you're like, oh, I've got a picture and I've got like a picture of a guy next to a server cabinet. But I'd like to make it look like he was next to 12 cabinets. I'd like to fill that space out. And you can do that kind of content. So that's really useful. So I have an original image and I need it tweaked a bit using it to be able to fill across.
Yeah. It's not quite right. Mm. Yeah. And you can edit it. Yep. That'd be nice. Yeah, all right, but that sounds cool. I have to go and maybe have a look at that. But, you've got to be in this, you know, once an innovation comes out in one space, then everyone has to be on it, right, or they get left behind. So I guess this is Google doing that.
Yeah.
Let's move on and discuss a little bit of hardware. Now, this is pretty exciting. Willow. Willow is Google's state-of-the-art quantum chip.
All about the qubits, baby.
Yeah.
All more about qubits, the qubits are better. More qubits are now. It is. It's flabbergasting, isn't it? So the TLDR on this is, it's all about reducing errors in a quantum computing. And what they found is the more qubits you add, the error rate reduces exponentially. So we've got 105 qubits in this new Willow chip. And it's been able to perform a standard computational benchmark in under 5 minutes that would take a fast classic computer, 10 septillion years.
I've got time. I can wait.
I feel like time. There should be a finger next to the mouth for this one. 10 septillion years.
Septillion years. Wow. Wow. The question I have about this is, we've got the chip, but I don't see any pictures of it here. What else do you need to support that chip? What sort of cryogenics units and, you know, power? Like, can I get one of these as a plug-in card for my computer? That's what I want.
Yeah.
No is the short answer for that.
Well, I mean, do you remember, though, when the first quantum computer was it IBM? Isn't that big one? It was all like brass and stuff looking.
That's right.
It was two qubits.
Yep.
And then now they've got it down to a chip sort of size, and it's a lot bigger, a lot as in more to it. So, it's coming along, fairly rapidly now.
Pretty rapid. I think I think we're there. So, take a quote from the article here. So they published in Nature and they found that the more qubits we use in Willow, the more we reduce errors and the more quantum the system becomes, right? We tested ever larger arrays of physical qubits starting at 3x3, then 5x5, then 7x7. And each time using our latest advances in quantum error correction, we were able to cut the error rate in half. In other words, we achieved the exponential reduction in the error rate. So you've got this array of qubits. You do your calculation, you can figure out which one the errors, you chuck the errors out, and bang, you've got your solution. So yeah, that's going to be, the more qubits you get, the higher resolution you're going to achieve and the less errors you're going to have.
Yeah, and I think the takeaway from this is, previously it was that the more qubits you had, the more errors you had in the previous model. So it was, this is a huge step forward by looking at how nature does this and then going, hey, let's replicate that.
Yeah, I guess they're calculating, they're coming up with some sort of mean calculation, right? To say, you know,
smoothing.
Yeah, some sort of smoothing. Yeah. We can more easily determine where the errors are if we've got a bigger array of qubits.
And I love that they're comparing this, like this one chip, to the Frontier supercomputer, which is the big US government one. And it is an absolute monster. So it does more than a quintillion calculations a second. So you've got an idea of just how big this thing is.
Yeah.
I mean, this article and this blog does cover it quite nicely, because I think then for me, I'm like, okay, cool, it does this amazing thing. So what's the real world application of this? And there isn't one, right? So, and the blog, the guy quite rightly says, is that, like, you know, let me quote here, is that on one hand, we've run the RCS benchmark, which measures performance against classical computers, but has no known real world applications. On the other hand, we've done, you know, scientifically interesting simulations of quantum systems, which have led to new scientific discoveries, but are still within the reach of classical computers. Our goal is to do both at the same time, to step into the realm of algorithms that are beyond the reach of classical computers and that are useful for real-world commercially relevant problems, right? So I think that's the key, right? It's like, they've got to build it to a point, and now they can start saying, like, all right, can we actually start doing useful work with these chips, or do we need to still evolve them a bit more? And their roadmap, I think, is quite interesting. Like, I think their next milestone is to build a long-lived logical qubit, but milestone 4 is to actually be able to create gates, right? And after that, then we're starting to get into, like, okay, we can have quantum chips that can also do classical computing kind of stuff too.
Right.
Yeah, I see quantum computers as more of a tool for the scientific community, perhaps, in predicting, you know, you look at the stuff that they're measuring at Large Hadron Collider and what astrophysicists are trying to calculate day in, day out. Maybe that's what the use case for these things is, or could be, at least.
Potentially.
Well, we just don't know yet, do we?
No, and neither do they. Yeah. I think that's the key. Like, right, we've got this amazing thing, we couldn't do it before. We're not sure what we can use it for yet, but it's going to be good.
It will lead somewhere, no doubt.
It'll do things really quickly.
Did we need those things to be done? Well, no, but that's not the point.
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether we need it or not. We can do it.
Well, speaking of getting somewhere eventually, the Trillium TPU, which we covered earlier in the year, is now generally available. Just to recap, the 6th generation tensor processing unit called Trillium is now generally available for Google Cloud customers. I didn't go and look to see if we can get it here in Australia Southeast 1 or 2, but yeah, you can go and set up your Trillium and do your AI stuff on that.
Not in Australia yet.
Not in Australia yet. Okay. Yeah.
Much like lots of stuff, not in Australia yet.
It's in the markets where people can pay for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the power's not expensive.
Yeah.
All right, cool. That was a quick short one, but let's get on with some security news. And this one, if it hasn't affected you already, it is going to affect you. MAF mandatory for Google Cloud, Android, and Workspace users in 2025. MAF is coming.
Yeah, MFA for all, which is excellent. Yep. Please, yes,
yeah,
thank you.
I 100% agree with this. MFA is the biggest thwarter of cybersecurity attacks there is. So get on it.
99% less likely to be affected by a hacking or cyber incident if you have MFA enabled on your account.
Yep.
So go do it, people.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. It's and then start looking at things like passkey.
Yeah. Yeah.
So passwordless authentication. Because that's another big solution to cybersecurity attacks.
Yeah. Yep. I've been loving passkeys and swapping them in on sites. It's been very handy.
Everything I can, I'll have passkeys. I've even got it on my, you've got your government accounts for everything. So I've got one for DBA, and I log into that and it's oh, do you want to add a passkey to this? Yes.
Yes. Right away. Bitwarden's doing it now, right? It pops up and says, you want to add a passkey? Yes, please. I'll add it. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. I didn't even think about it. It just kind of did it automatically.
Yep. And now I don't even have to, I don't log in. I just go log in with passkey. And Bitwarden prompts me and says, hey, do you want to use this passkey? Sure.
Yep. So just to recap, in early 2025, Google will mandate multi-factor authentication for all users who sign into their accounts with a password. It will be not only with Google, but with credential providers as well. So Google is working with all the other credential providers to make sure that that's going to be a smooth transition.
And it won't just be for Google itself too. It'll be for cloud as well and Firebase and like everything.
That's right. Mm. Yeah, yeah. It does have it here. Yeah. So Google Cloud Console, Firebase Console, G Cloud and other platforms to continue using these tools, you'll need to enroll in MFA. Awesome. So stay tuned for that one. And just to finish off the main news articles for this week, we've got a bit of a funny one here. Microsoft Bing is trying to spoof Google UI when people search google.com.
Yeah, this is dodgy.
This is dodgy. It's like bad.
let's be honest. Imitation is as sincere as form of flattery.
It totally is.
So thanks, Microsoft, for flattering Google. Because, you know, all you've done is just basically screenshotted the Google UI and gone, we're going to make that because it looks identical. What it is, though, is when you first fire up a Windows PC and you open up Edge for the first time and as you always do, you type in there Google Chrome because I'm not using Edge.
Specifically when you search for the term Google.
But you're right, Ian. When you type in Google Chrome into Edge, the first thing that it tells you is like, hey, you don't need to change browsers at all. We'll bet on the same stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah
don't switch away.
So what they do when you search for Google in Bing is they hide that top URL bar and then they put one of the really stylistic drawings that Google puts on its search page. And a clean UI there with the search bar in the middle and then the search results underneath it. So it looks exactly like a Google search page.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
And, yeah, the screenshots of it here are phenomenal.
I was really shocked when you linked this through. I was like, really? And I didn't like, oh, that's bad. That's sneaky, isn't it? So that's bad. Sneaky.
Yeah, so
but you got to be in incognito, in private mode to do it. If you're logged in, it doesn't do this behavior apparently.
If
you've got a fresh PC and you're not logged in, absolutely. Yeah.
So one of the things that the article said here is that a lot of users don't really care what search engine they use, and I'd probably debate that. So Microsoft's new practice, which might appear stupid, is likely very effective, and probably quite against the law.
Well, it's certainly skirting moral grounds, isn't it?
Yeah. It's potentially illegal, but definitely not ethically correct.
Yeah, it's the spirit of the law, if not the letter.
Yeah.
But
I have to say, the little picture they have there is very inclusive if you look at it. We've got all ethnicities shown there and, all people of all capabilities. So, you know, they've got that going for them.
But it's a very Google-esque drawing to have there.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. It's like stylized the same way as Google's drawings is. Yeah. So I question the moral integrity of the people at Microsoft who've done this.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that really stood out to me, and I think this is not like a Microsoft thing, but the website where this article came from, windowslatest.com. So it is not, okay, obviously we have a particular opinion about how this thing should be done.
No.
But these guys are clearly like they're Microsoft fanboys. Like they're a Windows site. Like obviously, like yes,
they're skirting around the main problem with this. Aren't
they're like, wow, it's genius that they've done this. It looks so much like Google. Like,
literally, and I quote: "This is a genius move to grab your attendance."
Like, oh my god! Really? Is it really?
I know so much about that. Oh,
and then have a scroll down and read like the comments. It's like, oh, these are the biggest like bootlickers of an organization. And I know this is a podcast where we talk about a lot of Google stuff, but I feel like we throw a fair amount of shade at Google too, right? Like,
Oh, yeah.
If you do something stupid, you deserve the shade.
I will be the first one to point out their flaws when they occur.
Yeah, so I was just like, "Come on, guys!" Like,
Anyway, the link in the show notes. Go check it out. And I don't have Edge installed on this machine, but I would definitely be going to do. I don't know if I should install Edge, but I'd go on and check that out now if I did. All right, then let's get on with the AI war. Yes, and while we're on a hardware tip, a couple of pieces of hardware from the AI wars here. And Dave, you've been postulating whether you should get yourself one of these. AI unveils its most affordable generative AI supercomputer.
So this has been a great one this week for the amount of hardware that we're covering, right?
We've got quantum
chips, we've got all sorts of stuff going off, right? But NVIDIA in fine form and just coming off the back of their keynote at CES this week, last week, which, side note, love when CES rolls around. There's all sorts of fun gadgets and things.
All sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah. But they have released, NVIDIA that is, their newest version of the Jetson developer board, which is a small system on a chip for doing AI work. And their new one, which is the Jetson Orin Nano. Is a full SBC. So if you picture like a Raspberry Pi-esque kind of device, single board computer, has all your I/O and everything on board, and is loaded with a particular NVIDIA Linux distribution with all of their AI tooling and everything on there. You can, create LLMs on there just to, I think it's a 1.7 times upgrade over their previous board.
Pretty impressive performance numbers there, if you look at it.
Yeah, and at like $250 US, which now these are available in Australia, but they're coming at about 1,000.
They're a bit more expensive.
They're a bit more expensive than that, but still not bad. I mean, if you think about how much Raspberry Pis, due to limited stock and just how they've kind of grown in cost over the years. This is a pretty powerful little board.
So the system on module is what they call it. Developer kit consists of a Jetson Orin Nano 8 gig system on module and a reference carrier board, providing ideal platform for prototyping Edge AI app. It's an NVIDIA Ampere architect GPU with tensor cores and 6-core ARM CPU. So it's not a small chip. It would be fairly power hungry, I would imagine.
25 watts, though, for the whole board.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. So that's actually not that bad.
Yeah, not that bad
at all. You could PoE that. Well, PoE plus, but, still. Yeah.
But runs NVIDIA AI software, including NVIDIA Isaac for robotic, Metropolis for vision AI, Holoscan for sensor processing. You can do all sorts of really cool stuff with this.
Yeah. You can probably even rip the NVIDIA Linux version off there and put Ubuntu or something else on there if you wanted to. you'd have to put all the Jetson AI stack back on, though, afterwards. But
yeah,
you would. Yeah, you would. Which, you know, it's probably an app getaway, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I can see, you know, get this in the hands of some small startups and some developers, and they're going to be able to do some really cool stuff with this.
Yeah,
for sure. That's a pretty, you know, reasonable sort of pricing for a little box like that, where you can do a lot of your own local development before you want to scale out to like a cloud resource afterwards.
Yep, yep. Be a good use case for it for sure. So check that out. Maybe even buy yourself one. And Dave, if you get one, let us know what it's all about. Also NVIDIA, gee, they're good. And we've got specs and announcements on the RTX 50 series now. So,
5090 at $4,000.
Yep.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, you can get one if you want.
Oh, man. There.
DLSS 4, while we're on the subject, DLSS 4, it can generate 3 out of 4 frames, intermittent frames, so it can like pretty much quadruple your frame rate.
Yeah. Or increase your quality drastically while, you know, running at the same frame rate.
Staggering, at the same frame rate, yeah, staggering. Wow. But this, NVIDIA puts Grace Blackwell on every desk. So this is a desktop supercomputer called the NVIDIA Digits. Gives you a GB10 superchip in a small form factor desktop machine.
Yeah, so now this is, you know, kind of, I guess, the bigger brother of the Nano that the we Nano, just yeah. went through, right? But this, I see them as targeting, like a lot of AI development happens on Mac Minis and Mac Studios, right? Heaps of it is done on, like, they're kind of a benchmark device for it. This is NVIDIA going after that market, right? Yeah. Especially their pricing, it's in kind of Mac Studio pricing.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So this is a device that is going to be about, when they come out in May, about $3,000 US, which, you know, considering the 5090 is a $4,000 GPU, or say $2,000 US. So, you know, that's, it's not bad.
Six by the time it's here.
Yeah. Yeah, plus add scalping tax. And
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's call it 8.
Well, I'm just hoping it brings the price of the 40 series down, because that's what I got my eye on.
Good luck. but yeah, so you've got this little device. It's I'm trying to picture the size. About the size of a standard kind of mini PC, maybe a little thicker. Very tasteful gold effect on it. Mm-hmm. But this unit on its own will run a 200 billion parameter model on it.
Oh,
right.
That is huge.
And not only has it got like a whole lot of specs on board, you can link two of these together, right? And you can run a 405 billion parameter model like Facebook's Llama model locally on this device, or I guess the pair of devices.
That's cool.
Staggering. Yeah.
So, yeah, each GB10 superchip, which is inside each one of these boxes, provides a petaflop of AI performance.
Yeah, at FP4 precision, which is, yeah, that's cool. That's really cool. It's got the chip-to-chip interconnect as well to give you that high-performance Grace CPU connection. That's how it does that, the 450 billion parameter model on two machines. Built with an ARM, it's a MediaTek core CPU by the looks of it.
Yes, indeed. And it comes with the full NVIDIA like enterprise AI stack on board. This is squarely targeted at, you know, like the local development. Obviously, a bit more well-heeled local development than people using the Orin Nano device, right?
Yeah.
You know, especially if you want to run those big models, you know, it took in like, you know, $6,000 to get going. But that's well within the, you know, realm of, you know, most businesses, anyone who can afford to pay an AI engineer at least.
Yeah, I think, what did it say here? So Project Digits features 128 gig of unified coherent memory and up to 4 terabytes of NVMe storage. So it's got a bit of beef to it too.
Yeah, and it's still like a full PC. Like it's not just
desktop. Yeah.
So you can, it's plugged into a monitor, has a keyboard and a mouse. You can work on it and do all the your lab work. Like, brilliant.
When are we going to see the NVIDIA motherboard? This is the thing, right? You got your gigabytes, you got your ASUSs, and you got your NVIDIA. I mean, we had the NVIDIA chipset, right? Years ago,
yeah. That was how you'd get your the only way to get Crossfire was that the
SLI.
SLI, yeah.
The
NVIDIA chips.
Yeah. The two video cards, yeah, or more. All right. Well, on that news, links in the show note for that. Go check that out. Go check out the rest of the CES stuff. Oh, and by the way, I was just watching before we went to air. Jimmy Fallon has interviewed Linus Sebastian from Linus Tech Tips, and he talks all about CES. So I'll put a link in the show notes with that one as well. That's where we are. If Linus is on Jimmy Fallon, well, the world's topsy-turvy.
Yep.
But go and check that out. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. Go to YouTube, start the discussion. You can contact the show, contact@gcpbytes.com.au. We are also on the web, www.gcpbytes.com.au. And of course, today's sponsor are Hive Tech Solutions and Mantle Group. Well, I think that's about it from us. You guys got anything else to add?
No, it's been a cracking first show of the year.
No, only just that, while we're sitting here, I just got an email from Starlink because I had an account years ago, and since I had fiber, I've had it deactivated. The Starlink have just contacted me and said, like, hey, you know, you can use your Starlink dish for $15 a month as a backup service. That's a very nice little
very tantalizing, yeah, especially since you're running a bit. You're running a business from there. That's probably a good little security net.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it for me.
Dave's going to have dual internet before the end of the day.
All right, well, that's it from us. We'll catch you in a fortnight. Bye.
Bye. See ya.
Well, so if you think of a 400 megahertz wave, the distance between the start of the sine wave and the end of the sine wave,
yeah, peak.
If you do the maths, it's the inverse. The wavelength is the inverse of the cycles per second. It's 0.75 meters. I just asked Gemini that. It did the maths for me, 0.75 meters. So a 400 megahertz, so most CB antennas that you see in the front of four-wheel drives, they're about that long, right? Yeah. They're like just under a meter in length, 0.75. And then you've got the short little stubby ones, which are half wavelength. So you only just get the node of the thing.